I just got a big thumbs up, so if you are ready, Kat, we can go ahead.
I sure am.
Okay, awesome. All right. Kat, what inspired you to write The Secret Life of Sleep?
I have always loved to sleep. It's always been a favorite thing of mine. And such a mystery. It's such a mysterious thing. What happens during all those hours that we can't remember?
Yeah.
And as a writer, I like to explore those common everyday experiences that we tend to overlook or forget or pay no attention to. My first book was about illness, and when I sat down to start another writing project, the subject of sleep jumped on the page, and I thought, oh, boy, this will be fun.
Yeah, and obviously it was fun. I'm sure it was fun to write, although at times probably difficult, as writing often is, but it's sure a lot fun. It sure is fun to read. And as you mentioned, Kat, you've always liked to sleep, and even when you were a young girl, and I may be in the minority here, but when I was a young boy, I didn't really enjoy sleeping at all. What was it that you liked about sleeping when you were young?
I loved the chance to let everything and everybody go and go in my own room. You know, we tend to romanticize childhood as a carefree time, but there's a lot of pressure to live up to everybody's expectations, and I loved being able to shut the door on that and go into my own room, be unsupervised and by myself, and have my own private experiences.
And you still like sleeping. Do you think you enjoy it more as an adult than when you were a kid, or...
I don't know. I still like to sleep, but there are nights when I'm up reading or writing or thinking about something, and I don't want to go to bed. I want to keep on doing it, but I make myself go to bed eventually.
You write that our waking selves are like lily pads floating on the surface of our night selves, and that's a really beautiful phrase. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yes. There's various levels of that. Very literally... our sleep lives support our day lives. There's so much that goes on when we sleep. We regenerate tissues, we build bones, we make memories, we strengthen our immunity, we sort through our emotional issues. So much goes on. We would not be anything in the daytime if we didn't have our sleep. So literally, sleep supports our day lives. But on another level, I've always had the sense that sleep is a bigger world than the one I inhabit by day. And I think that cognitive psychologists are really beginning to confirm that notion as they begin to define the breadth and depth of our unconscious processing that goes on all the time. We'll notice it every now and then. For example, if you're trying to tell a friend about a movie and you can't remember the name of the movie, and an hour later when you're doing something totally different, it pops in your head. Well, during that hour, all that unconscious processing was going on and accessing information that you couldn't access in the moment by day.
Go ahead.
There's just such a large field of experience and knowledge that we get to tap into.
Kind of a yin-yang thing almost, a way our dreaming, our sleeping life informs our waking life and vice versa.
Yes, I think that's a wonderful analogy.
As the title of your book, The Secret Life of Sleep, conveys, we don't know that much about sleep because it lies outside of our conscious awareness. And you've done a lot of research into the science of sleep. How much do we really know about it?
I'm sure we're still scratching the surface. Scientific inquiry of sleep is actually fairly recent, just started up in the middle of the 20th century with the development of things like the electroencephalogram and other brain imaging techniques that have allowed us to find out that there's a lot of activity going on inside of us when we sleep. But when you get outside of that Western scientific tradition, there are traditions throughout the world that have thousands of years of observation about sleep. And one of the interesting things to me that I discovered in the research here is that ancient Hindu and Buddhist texts from BC times identified stages of sleep that are now being confirmed by neuroscientists, you know, here in the 21st century.
What kinds of stages of sleep are we talking about here?
Well, for example, Hindu and Buddhist texts will talk about dream sleep and deep sleep. In the parlance of contemporary neuroscience, that would be rapid eye movement sleep or REM sleep, and deep slow wave sleep. They're very similar.
And was that something that you uncovered when you were researching the book?
Yes. Yeah. I have some familiarity with Hindu and Buddhist traditions, and I knew that in Asian traditions, they've considered sleep to be a valuable part of our day for a long, long time, whereas in the West, the whole Western philosophic tradition developed basically on looking at our waking lives and not paying attention to our sleeping lives. So I knew that there was a body of knowledge there, but I hadn't really gone into it before this book.
Mm. We're told that the ideal amount of sleep to get is 8 hours every night. Is this true?
Well, it is a normative average of but I'm sure most sleep scientists and sleep doctors would give you a range of something like 7 to 9 hours. It is a very individual thing. Some people don't do well unless they have 9 or 10 hours, and others can do well on 4 or 5. But that's the normative average.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people like Martha Stewart and Bill Clinton have said that they get by on 4 hours of sleep. Do you think that's possible? That seems like, because that's half the recommended daily allowance. Do you think it's really possible to get by on that little sleep?
Well, as Bill Clinton has acknowledged, I think he literally said when he was asked if he would give any advice to the incoming President Obama, and he said, get enough sleep. He said, all the mistakes I've made in my political career were from trying too hard and not getting enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tricky things about if you actually do need more sleep, but you're only getting 4 or 5, one of the first abilities that we lose with sleep deprivation is that capacity to observe ourselves and look at our behaviors. So someone may think they're doing just fine in 4 or 5 hours, but if you talk to their family, they'll say they're irritable and impatient. You talk to their coworkers, and they say they have to go over their work because there's so many mistakes.
Mm.
So we aren't always the best judge.
Yeah. How much sleep do you get?
I'm a 9-hour. Mm. I just do best on 9 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the ways to tell how much sleep you need is how well you function during the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
If you're able to stay comfortably awake all day, then you're probably getting enough sleep. But if you are having to drag yourself out of bed and pump coffee all day or grab that double-sized Coke at 3 p.m, then you probably aren't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. More than 60% of Americans experience habitual sleep problems. Why do you think we're getting less and less sleep these days?
Oh, well, that's the $1,000,001 question.
Yeah.
We are getting 1 hour less on average than we did in 1980 and an hour and a half less than we did in 1960.
Hmm.
I think there's a few factors involved. One is technological advances, most especially light. Once we brought light into the night hours, that started to confuse our circadian cycles because they are sleep. Stage of the cycle is initiated by darkness. So if we aren't getting darkness, that becomes a problem. We also have a lot of demands on our time these days. The average American works a full extra month a year than they did in 1980, and our expectations of our productivity are so much higher. And so we have a lot of demands on our time. And also I would add the cultural attitude, which I would call a bad attitude about sleep, which is, I'll get it later, you know.
Yeah, I'll sleep when I'm dead.
Right, that exactly.
Kind of thing.
Ben Franklin's famous saying, you know, there'll be plenty of sleep in the grave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're often told that sleep is when our bodies and brains shut down to take a rest. Is this true?
It's not true at all.
No?
In fact, that was one of the misunderstandings that was held for, centuries in the West and was disproven once they developed the EEG machine and saw that actually our brains are very active. It seems funny to me because I think dreamers and people around the world would have said, of course we're active in our sleep. A lot goes on. We just don't remember it. But now we have the tools to define and measure and quantify exactly that kind of activity. And in fact, sometimes our brains are more active when we're asleep than when we're awake.
Really? Is that when we're dreaming? Is that when our brains would be more active than when we're awake?
Yes, that would tend to happen during the lighter REM phase, rapid eye movement phase. We dream more during REM sleep, although we mm-hmm. don't do all of our dreaming then.
Yeah. So what exactly is going on in our brains while we sleep?
Oh, gosh. It is an amazing rhythmic fluctuation of chemicals and electricity that's going on there through cycling through lighter and deeper phases of sleep and accomplishing so many tasks from there are a couple neuroscientists who study sleep who call it overnight therapy. It is a lot of what goes on in our REM sleep. We're working with a lot of emotional issues and charged issues. But we're also making memories. We're filing memories. We are strengthening our immunity. We're removing toxins from our brains. So much is going on.
Mm-hmm. And the difference between our deep, slow-wave sleep and the REM sleep, What would you say the big differences are? I would imagine the deep slow wave sleep is more restorative. That's where we're kind of recharging our brains and bodies. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, it is definitely the most physically restorative part of sleep is deep sleep. That's when the parasympathetic nervous system is strongest, and that's that rest and digest calming time. REM sleep is more active. It's a lighter sleep. We do very important, as I said, emotional processing in REM sleep. Mm-hmm. We're also doing some making meaning out of our experiences and filing and sorting our memories so that they can be most useful and available later on.
Yeah, and is that also, I would imagine, REM sleep is where we're doing problem solving, where our subconscious has a chance to kind of dwell on things and maybe come up with solutions to problems we're wrestling with?
Yes, I don't know for sure. We know for sure that sleep does, a lot of problem solving goes on in sleep. I'm not sure that all of it happens in REM sleep, but I'm sure a good part of it does. We rehearse and develop a lot of survival strategies through our dreams, and if something is a problem, then we're going to try and work it out for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. Are we conscious when we dream?
It's so interesting to think about that, isn't it? That was one of the
yeah.
surprising things as I started to read neuroscientists talking about sleep. Not all neuroscientists, but a good body of neuroscientists say, yes, we are conscious. Rudolfo Linus says that dreaming actually is consciousness itself in the absence of sensory input.
Huh.
I think the key question is, what are we conscious of? When we're dreaming, we're very conscious of the imaginary world we've created for ourselves, we might say, that we call dreams. We aren't as conscious of what is going on in our environments.
Yeah. So you mentioned, I think, in your book that even ancient philosophers said that we're conscious when we dream.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's amazing.
And even in the West, you can go back to Aristotle and some of the others, yes.
Wow, so it's kind of like if those guys and the other, who was it, the Egyptians or the other people we were mm-hmm. talking about, ancient civilizations, if they were still around, maybe they would have solved. We'd be further ahead in sleep research, just how prophetic they are. Yeah.
Well, they did a lot of observation of it and then passed that knowledge on. It's its own kind of scientific inquiry to just observe one's experiences.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think is the biggest sleep-related question that neuroscientists and sleep researchers are still trying to answer?
Well, I believe what they would say is why we sleep, because I've often heard that and read that from neuroscientists who study sleep. It seems an odd question to me, or an odd thing to think that we haven't answered that question, because we've identified so many things that happen in sleep that really couldn't happen when we're awake.
Yeah.
But I think that the hesitancy to say that's the reason is because it's still hard for us to accept that we are basically earthly creatures. We are born on this planet that rotates and has alternating phases of light and darkness, and we are created in that milieu, and every plant and animal, every cell of our bodies, every single-celled organism has an inbuilt circadian cycle of phases of activity, phases of rest, and I think sleep is just a function of that. And it's hard for us to really believe that we're that earthly.
Yeah, exactly. There's this kind of sense of we're above it all and we're immortal. And I mean, it ties in. I was thinking while you were answering that, Kat, it ties in with this science fictional goal of at some point in the future, you know, we won't need sleep at all. Why do we need to sleep? The whole sleep when we're dead
right.
thing. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You write about sleeping pills, and they are among the most advertised, most prescribed, and most profitable drugs, billions of dollars a year, right?
Yes, yeah. $4.5 billion is the last I heard.
Right. How effective are they?
Well, they don't lengthen our sleep time very much. The studies have consistently reported 11 to 14 minutes added to your total sleep time. However, they do. If you talk to someone who takes sleep medication, they'll say, "Oh no, it does a lot more. It does much more for my sleep. I sleep much better with my pills," and that's because sleeping pills do a couple of other things. First of all, they reduce our anxiety, so we fall asleep more quickly. We're less worried about whether we're going to fall asleep or not. And we wake up a little calmer. They also induce a retrograde amnesia, so we don't remember any tossing and turning we did in the night. So we wake up feeling like we had better sleep. The other thing to remember with most sleep medications, is that they reduce the time we spend in deep sleep. That's that most physically restorative sleep. And in general, as we age, we spend less and less time in deep sleep. And that is correlated with a lot of the signs of aging that we notice and bemoan. Everything from wrinkles and thinner skin to weaker muscles to memory lapses, all those things are clearly correlated with less deep sleep. So if someone is chronically taking sleeping pills, they are, in a sense, accelerating their aging by having consistently less time in deep sleep.
Mm. Yeah, and it sounds like there's kind of a placebo effect, too, just the mere fact of, taking this will help me sleep. And
They actually did a study where they told people that they had slept well, and they actually functioned better that day, even though they hadn't slept as well as they were told they were.
Yeah. What about sleep aids, things like earplugs, white noise machines, aromatherapy pills, and especially mattresses? Do any of these work?
Well, any kind of environmental adaptation you can make to your sleep is probably going to help. If the problem is noise, if you've got a garbage truck that comes by at 3 a.m. or neighbor dogs that are barking, then a white noise machine or earplugs, that may be the ticket for you. Mm-hmm. If you are a night owl and you're trying to force yourself to go to bed and fall asleep, at 8 or 9 every night, you're kind of wasting your time because your circadian cycle hasn't kicked in to foster sleep. So if you can adapt your environment, adapt the time to suit you best, then those are the things that are really going to help you. And so it ends up being very individual.
Mm-hmm. But there's only so much we can do, isn't there? Like, if we're not independently wealthy and we have a job to go to, some employers might let you adjust your hours, but a lot of times you have to work 9 to 5, even if you're a night owl, or you could try and find work that suits, that you're happy with, that suits your nocturnal habits. But that's easier said than done, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely easier said than done. I mean, you talk to people who work night shifts, and they're usually night owls, and that's a good thing. If you are more of a night owl and you're having to work a job that gets you up early, the best thing you can do is take a nap later in the day, like when you get home.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers, by nature, are night owls. That is, their circadian cycles advance an hour and a half or so, and so they naturally are inclined to stay up late and sleep late. Of course, our schools want to start early, and so you have a whole age and generation that is sleep deprived typically. And if they can just come home and take a nap and then go on to their night lives, they're going to do much better.
Yeah, the power of napping. Throughout your book, you write about some of the dreams that you've had, and there's one in particular that I'd like to ask you about. It was about, I think you had this dream a few years ago. It was about a drive you took down a winding canyon road. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I do.
Yeah, can you tell me about that one?
Yeah, the dream was that I was trying to go to Ojo Caliente, which is about an hour and a half away from home. And in the dream, I was taking this road, dirt road that goes there, and it has to go down into the Rio Grande Gorge, and so it winds along the side of a very steep gorge, a little narrow dirt road, and then crosses the river and then goes back up the side of the other. And in the dream, I was driving a little too fast, which I am prone to do, and I came around a blind corner, and a car was right in front of me coming the other way, and I veered to miss the car, and I went over the edge of the canyon.
Yeah, and then something happened the next day, right? Because didn't you have to actually drive that canyon road?
I did. I was going to an appointment in Ojo Caliente, and I woke up that morning. It's very unusual for me to dream about something that I'm getting ready to do the next day. I was getting ready to drive that road down through the canyon to the appointment. And so when I had that dream, I thought, gosh, you know. It scared me a little bit, and I contemplated going way out of my way to go a different way and not have to go down into the canyon, but I love that canyon. So I decided, oh, heck, I'll just leave a little earlier and take my time. And then, of course, you know, I was going along, and I'd totally forgotten about the dream, and I was heading down into the canyon, and I had all the windows open. It was a beautiful day. I had my favorite CD on. I was singing along, and I had totally forgotten about the dream, and a bee flew into my car. Now, at the time, I thought I was allergic to bees. I'd had a couple of big reactions to bee stings, so I was frightened, and I turned to look to see where the bee was, and when I looked back, there was a car coming the other way right towards me, and I veered a little bit to get out of the way, but we kind of skidded parallel to each other and around each other. I did not go over the edge.
Wow.
I was really glad that I was not going as fast as I am prone to do.
And do you think you were not going as fast because of the dream that you'd had the night before?
I know that I had decided to leave earlier. That was my kind of response to getting that dream, because it was so unusual. Usually I dream about, all sorts of other things or crazy things where I'm back in high school or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this felt a little bit like a warning.
Yeah, yeah. So that this was unusual. Have you had any other prophetic dreams like that?
You know, I have watched my dreams for many years and written down my dreams. And people who do that oftentimes notice later on that they've had prophetic dreams. And when you look at dream traditions from a lot of cultures around the world, they inevitably mention that it's possible to have a prophetic dream. The tricky thing with prophetic dreams is that it's hard to pick out the dream that's prophetic from all the others that aren't prophetic. And so it's sort of like finding the needle in the haystack. But when you look back over your dreams from the past, you go, oh, my gosh, 10 years ago I dreamt this thing that happened last year.
Yeah, yeah. Eastern philosophy has a very different way of looking at sleep from the way we here in the West look at it, doesn't it?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Totally.
What are the biggest differences?
Well, from the, and especially I'm talking about Hindu and Buddhist traditions, but also Taoist traditions and Sufi traditions within the Islamic traditions.
Mm-hmm.
They all, and of course, their focus is more on what they would call a spiritual improvement rather than your daytime work productivity, which tends to be our focus here more in this culture.
Right.
And so they say that deep sleep is the most enlightened phase of consciousness that we ever experience. The Taoists say sleep is the wisdom of not knowing anything.
Hmm. Even though, so that, sorry to interrupt there, Kat, but deep sleep is in enlightening, so are they, but they think that dreams happen in REM sleep, right? Are they discounting the importance of dreams? Or?
It's a little hard for us to grasp. If we go back to what neuroscientists are saying, that basically what we call our daily waking consciousness is the same as dreaming, except that when we're awake, we're aware of sensory input of whether it's dark or light, warm or cold. When we're asleep, we aren't taking in information from our senses. And that coincides or nicely fits with the Asian traditions that talk about how we are always dreaming. We're always kind of projecting onto our worlds. We have these attitudes and assumptions and knowledge and facts and ideas and expectations of things that we're constantly kind of throwing up onto our experience. Throwing up meaning projecting it upon our experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to realize that when we're awake. It's a little easier to realize that when we're asleep and dreaming, because we know oftentimes, you know, this is crazy. This is, you know, not real. But when we go into that deep sleep, we actually drop all those expectations, all those things we think we know, all those roles. They say that's where you can find bliss. That's where you can reach a kind of clear mind in the Buddhist sense. And it's interesting because neuroscientists have begun to talk about something that happens in our deep sleep that does not happen at any other time, not even when we're put out for surgery or in a coma or anything else. And what happens is that the linkages between different parts of our brains weaken. They aren't destroyed, but they weaken. And a lot of those pathways that kind of spread like a web through different parts of our brains are the results of our experiences and what we've learned from our experiences. So in a sense, we weaken that set of things that we have learned from our experiences, which you could also call illusions. And we weaken those and, in a sense, let them dissolve into something that's just more pure.
Hmm. Interesting. And also, I was struck by this quote you have from an Indian philosopher about Dr. T.M.P. Mahadevan. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, about this whole East Indians drawing from all states of consciousness, including those of sleep, to develop their views of reality, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Near the end of your book, you say that our sleep is being sold back to us. Can you explain what you mean?
Yes, you know, as I did the research and was writing the book, I came to realize that sleep is really a natural resource. It's like the air we breathe, the water we drink, and in fact, we need it as much as we need the air we breathe and the water we drink. In fact, without sleep, we would die sooner than we would without air or water.
Can you, sorry, Kat, you cut out a bit there. Can you just back up? The phone went dead. Can you just back up about just a couple sentences? I don't remember. Just talk about comparing it to air and water. It's a natural resource.
Yes.
And just continue from there. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Yeah. As a natural resource, we need sleep as much as we need the air we breathe and the water we drink. In fact, we would die sooner without it than we would without air or water. And as is, there was a time, even in my lifetime, when you could drink out of a stream or a lake. You know, no one would dream of doing that now. And in fact, we buy water in bottles. We buy water that was a natural resource initially, and we didn't protect it well enough, and now we have to buy it. Same thing with our sleep. It's been a natural resource. It's a God-given right, we might say.
Mm-hmm.
We're born with that capacity, and we haven't protected it. We've allowed it to erode, and now we are buying the mattresses and the sleep masks and the medications, and it's being sold back to us.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very powerful, great, poetic way of looking at it. You pose an interesting question at the end of your book that I'd like to ask you now. What does sleep look like from sleep's perspective?
I wish I could ask that of my sleep itself and have an answer. What I imagine it might look like is that sleep repairs the damage that we do by day.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How has writing The Secret Life of Sleep changed the way you think about sleep?
You know, I've come to think of sleep as my best friend and helper.
Hmm.
I've always enjoyed sleeping, but I've never really realized how much it helps me and how much I can turn to it. I can turn to it to help me remember things. I can turn to it to help me solve problems, even little things. If I can't think of a birthday present for someone, I just go to sleep on it.
You know? Yeah.
And if I'm really upset about something, I tell myself, okay, don't stay up going over and over the same old line of thought you've had. Let it go, give it to your sleep, and see what comes out the next day. It's such a great ally and friend, and that's, I would say, the best thing that I've learned from this.
Mm, that's great. Very well said, Kat. Kat, that's all I have for questions. Thank you. That was wonderful. Anything you felt we missed?
Oh, I think we covered a lot of territory.
It was
great.
Yeah.